What is the reason that all bad people don't get their assets taken off them every time? Is it a legislation thing? Is it a funding or review thing?
Yes, to all of those questions that you just asked. Yes. In other countries, a lot of times they call it non-conviction-based forfeiture. Basically, you don't have a body. Like, you don't have a defendant. You can't get the guy and say, okay, you committed this crime, ergo, we're taking all the stuff. It actually comes from admiralty law. Pirate ship shows up in the bay, tons of stuff on it. You know, that ain't your stuff. So then you take the stuff and you say, okay, pirates, just prove that you own it. Like, show me, you know, bills of lading, show me where it originated, just show me your proof of ownership. And when they didn't show up, you got to keep the stuff. And this actually translates to crypto quite well. And this is why non-conviction-based forfeiture is so essential to crypto, because when you have people in foreign jurisdictions who can't be extradited, when the resources of state and federal governments cannot go grab somebody from China, from Russia, at least you need a process for hopefully getting back the funds, which are oftentimes at exchanges that are hopefully regulated in jurisdictions that cooperate from law enforcement. So one of the biggest threats right now, a real like existential threat to victims of financial crime, is attacks on non-conviction-based forfeiture. It's probably the thing I'm like most passionate about. These groups who take one bad case and then want to throw millions of financial fraud victims out with the bathwater just because something goes wrong in a civil case and all of a sudden you should abolish it.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Cease and Desist. I'm Joanna Summers, SVP of Professional Services at Asset Reality and proud member of the Association for Women in Cryptocurrency and the Mid-Atlantic Regional Ambassador. From her pivotal roles in the government, including serving as the Senior Investigative Counsel for the U.S. House of Representatives and Senior Policy Advisor at the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, to her work as the Chief of Legal Affairs at Chainalysis, Amanda has been a driving force behind some of the key policies shaping our financial landscape. Amanda is dedicated to fostering inclusivity and empowerment across the digital finance ecosystem, and as the founder of the Association for Women in Cryptocurrency, Amanda has championed initiatives such as Unmanned Your Panel that aim at breaking down barriers and paving the way for a more diverse industry. In this episode, recorded on the 15th of February, Aiden and Amanda explore how her background in policy, enforcement, and legal affairs have shaped her views on cryptocurrency and asset forfeiture, the complexities of civil forfeiture, the use of cryptocurrency to finance terrorism, why we need an association for women in cryptocurrency, and the industry changes Amanda would like to see. Whether you're new to the world of seized asset recovery or you're a seasoned pro, this episode promises to expand your understanding of civil asset forfeiture, also known as non-conviction-based forfeiture, explore the uses of cryptocurrency, and offer a glimpse into the future of digital finance. Thank you for listening.
Welcome, Amanda Wick, to Cease and Desist podcast. We wanted to do this podcast because we know that anytime we sit down and chat, we go down all of these rabbit holes. And one of the things that sort of gave us the inspiration for the podcast was the Simon Sinek video, Be the Idiot. He calls it Be the Stupidest Person in the Room, because one of the things that I think plagues our industry, and this is across asset recovery, it's across crypto especially, is people being afraid to put their hand up and just say, I have no idea what you're talking about, or I don't get, and not remembering that sometimes it's a failure of the person teaching you. Like, it's not your fault you don't understand it. And one of the, I often quote you, and I always use you as an example, as one of the first people I met that would have merrily
stood up and said, I'm the idiot.
No, much more delicately, but it would be a case of going, I have no idea what you're saying, or to other people on the call, and the six people on a call, everyone's nodding along. And then you're like, I have no idea what you're saying to the person. And everyone else would be messaging you privately going, thank God, because I had no idea what this person was saying. So I wanted to sort of dive in with you, because one of the things we're going to do as part of this sort of series is we're going to be exploring a lot of the big challenges. We're going to be the idiot in the room. We're going to ask all of the questions. We're going to be the person that stops and asks the questions. But I think it's also wrong of us to not interview the people that everybody seems to know in the sector for a whole bunch of different reasons. And they'll obviously not know that a lot of people have different histories coming into this. And some people will know you for the work you've done with AWIC, which we'll dive into. Other people will know you from your Chainalysis days. And I'm even more interested in your career before that, because it gives you such a unique perspective into what we're trying to get to the bottom of. And we're basically trying to look at why is it that terribly small amount of assets is recovered globally? The money that goes back into, you know, compensate victims, fund law enforcement, get back into society. And I think you have probably one of the most unique perspectives of anyone we'll speak to, because you've hit on all different parts of the sectors. And in a much smaller scale, I think that that's sort of why I'm in the job that I'm in, because I've been the investigator, I've managed the seizure, I've worked with the victims, and I've also now tried to work with the charities who try to get money to fund more projects. And I've actually received the funding myself as an 11-year-old. I've actually been in projects that were funded by Proceeds of Crime. So could you tell us a little bit about your background for those that don't see past the very, very busy and active LinkedIn pages and the whirlwind of activity you're involved in? So tell us how you got to here.
Yeah, before I ran a nonprofit, I say I'm a recovering lawyer, because prior to that, I spent nearly a decade as a federal prosecutor at the U.S. Department of Justice. And I think one of the reasons why you and I have so much in common is because I started in the Atlanta U.S. Attorney's Office and very quickly became fascinated with the woman who ran what's called their SAR review team. And a SAR, I think in other countries, sometimes called an STR, suspicious activity report, suspicious transaction report. It's basically a financial crime review team to see like what needs to be followed up on. Right? Financial institutions file them, and then we follow them to work on them. And not all of my cases necessarily came from that, but it was something I was immediately fascinated with. And then I left and went to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Birmingham, Alabama, where for 3 years I got to actually run my own team, which was an amazing opportunity. And I was in the asset forfeiture unit. I think asset forfeiture attorneys, like, we are a rare breed, because we are the guy in the basement with a stapler that everybody comes down to and is like, can you do my asset forfeiture work? Because a lot of prosecutors don't learn it, and it's really unfortunate. It's a essential area of legal practice, of criminal cases, of civil cases, but for a number of reasons, the Department of Justice historically has kind of allowed it to be outsourced, as opposed to it being like any other skill that you'd be required to learn as a prosecutor. There's usually just some person in an office that does it for you. And that, I know we're going to talk about it, but I think that's actually contributed a lot to why the world is, especially in the United States, why folks are so bad at it. Because when you have a skill that's specialized and separate that you outsource to a smaller group, that's why a lot of prosecutors just get prison time. And they don't focus on recovering the assets for victims. And you'll see these like massive cases that Maine Justice does sometimes, or that U.S. Attorney's offices do sometimes, where there's little to no asset recovery. And that's usually because the main prosecutors involved either A, didn't know what they didn't know, or B, didn't go and ask somebody for help to do the asset recovery. And maybe they get a body, maybe after years they extradite. And then we end up spending, you know, $40,000 to the Bureau of Prisons to house them, feed them, clothe them, and educate them for the next 40 years, but they don't get a cent back for the victim, which for me is a heartbreaking resolution when you have financial fraud and somebody whose life was ruined. And all of my victims of financial fraud would have much preferred to have their money back. If you made them choose, guy sits in jail for 20 years, or you get all your money back, every single one of them would have chosen to get their money back.
I found a really interesting study in the UK. It was from the, I think it was Home Office or National Crime Agency. They talked about the socioeconomic impact of this crime type. And thinking of, if you imagine society has one big ledger and you've already got the victims who've lost money, you then got the cost of the prosecution, the cost of the investigation, the cost of no jail or incarceration as well. They even went further to things like, if you've got a guy or a girl who's been convicted of this crime and they've got a child or their family or someone they care for, who's someone who relies on them, and then that person ends up in care, and then that person is statistically more likely to offend if they've been in a family where there's been an offender. And they did this whole exercise, and it was like the cost of like organized crime just in the UK was like £37 billion per year. So all of a sudden it was like, no, we're recovering hundreds of millions, but the actual impact, you know, park all of the big estimates on illicit finances, like we can actually start to quantify. But just to take it back a step, give me the 101 for those that don't know, our mantra of keeping it simple and asking the questions that people often don't ask. What the hell is forfeiture? We all know that people get arrested. We all know that they investigate the bad guys. We all know that the bad guys get locked up and stuck in prison. What is the actual forfeiture process, and why is it not just automatic? Is it a legislation thing? Is it a funding or review thing? What is the reason that all bad people don't get their assets taken off them every time?
Yes. To all of those questions that you just asked. Yes, it is all of the problems. So the issue with asset forfeiture, and you'll sometimes hear it called asset recovery. It went through a little whitewashing a few years ago in the United States, and now they call it asset recovery. I will say, in fairness, it's generally called asset recovery around the world. In the US, it was called forfeiture. So I think there's a consistency change there. But really what it is it's the process by which in many countries you have rules against depriving somebody of life, liberty, and property, right? But the reality is the rules for depriving you of your liberty and putting you in jail for good reason are much higher than that of depriving you of property, right? If I'm putting you behind bars, I want a higher legal standard, like in the United States, beyond a reasonable doubt. But if I'm taking stuff, that reasonably should be a lower standard. Like, some people can disagree with that. Those people are idiots. Call me, I'll explain to you why. But realistically, like, that lower standard in the United States is more likely than not, right? It's like 51%. I can prove that these things don't belong to you.
So is that the difference? Is that like civil and criminal, where it's like the burden of proof, the civil burden of proof?
Yes.
It's like, yeah, walks like a duck, quacks, yes, like a duck, looks like a duck.
Exactly. So in other countries, they call, a lot of times they call it non-conviction based forfeiture. And in the United States, we call it civil forfeiture, but they refer to the same thing, which is basically you don't have a body. You don't have a defendant. You can't get the guy and say, okay, you committed this crime, ergo, we're taking all the stuff that you committed from the crime. It's, we don't have a body, but what we do have is stuff, and we know it's not your stuff. So we do the stuff and we say, hey, if you're the rightful owner of this, just come forward and claim it and we'll process it. Like, and you could just have it. Fun fact, I'm going to nerd out for a second. It actually comes from admiralty law, where hundreds of years ago you had pirates. Pirate ship shows up in the bay, tons of stuff on it. You know, that ain't your stuff. Like, but I don't have the ship you sunk that you killed all the people because you killed all the witnesses. I have a ship full of stuff that you don't have bills of lading for, that you have no proof that you own, but you magically showed up with what looks like somebody else's stuff. So then you take the stuff and you say, okay, pirates, just prove that you own it. Like, show me, you know, bills of lading, show me where it originated, just show me your proof of ownership.
Just give me something.
Just give me proof of ownership. And when they didn't show up, you got to keep the stuff. So at least you got the stuff. All those people, poor people died on the ship, right? It's difficult to prove because I can't imprison all the pirates because they killed a bunch of people out on the water. And this actually translates to crypto quite well. And this is why non-conviction-based forfeiture is so essential to crypto, because when you have people in foreign jurisdictions who can't be extradited, when the resources of state and federal governments cannot go grab somebody from China, from Russia, from non-extraditable countries, where a lot of these crimes are being committed, at least you need a process for hopefully getting back the funds, which are oftentimes at exchanges that are hopefully regulated in jurisdictions that cooperate from law enforcement. So one of the biggest threats right now, a real, like, existential threat to victims of financial crime, is attacks on non-conviction-based forfeiture. It's probably one of the things I'm, like, most passionate about, is these nutjob civil liberty groups who take one bad case and then want to throw millions of financial fraud victims out with the bathwater just because something goes wrong in a civil case and all of a sudden you should abolish it because it's a civil rights violation.
I want to dive into that, because a lot of, you're a sort of woman after my own heart here. I rant about this all the time, and I adore the fact that with crypto, which we'll dive into, you can actually create such an immutable link to an offense on dark web, no, child exploitation, anything, that it's like that pirate example, which I didn't know the admiralty bit, glad I learned that. I didn't know that was the link. But I always liken it to, you know, the hotel room full of, you know, guns, drugs, cash, Rolexes, and the guys jumped out the window and ran off. The assets aren't just going to sit in purgatory now because you don't know who it is, but it's like, pretty much good evidence here that a crime has taken place. We're going to forfeit the Rolex and the expensive, you know, Louis Vuitton luggage, and we're going to take all of that sort of stuff. Otherwise, it just gets stuck forever. And I think that it would be useful to hear your take on it. I've tracked those stories where civil forfeiture sort of gone wrong and over-exuberant civil forfeiture, but we have locked people up for 60 years when they have been innocent. We have hung and killed people when they and convicted them to death sentences when they have been innocent. I mean, this is just as tragic and as terrible as those individual cases are in civil forfeiture. There is always going to be the cost of doing business. There will always be a tragic and small percentage. You cannot just, as you say, just throw the baby out with the bathwater. But is that what this is about right now?
It is funny to me. That is such a good point. I never thought about that. But I do want to go to, like, I think it's called the Institute for Justice, ironically named in the United States or so. I might not be getting that right, but like, it's, their name is, every time I see it, it's ironic, because I'm like, I wish you would just join forces with the Innocence Project. Legitimate use of time. If you're going to worry about the situations where the system system gets it wrong. Depriving somebody of liberty, 100%. Look, I'm not saying that these cases aren't really sad, because there are absolutely situations where somebody's car gets seized and they don't have it for several months until it gets returned, and maybe they lose their job.
This is the classic example. Yeah, for the non-US folks, one of the big cases I followed was, it was someone like a teenager had marijuana on his porch, and they turn up and basically the mom and dad are getting their house seized off the back of this because there's drugs in the property type of thing. That's obviously it at its worst. And then some people will argue and say parents were turning a blind eye to the kids, no, using drugs in the property.
Yeah, I was just about to say, let's be clear about what they legally had to show in order to seize that property. And they frequently, that's the thing that annoys me, is they frequently leave those facts out. I remember years ago, the Washington Post did an article on civil forfeiture. The DOJ spent weeks providing them with facts. And then the article came out and it was all crap. They ignored everything. They just took everything from one side. This has been my experience with the Washington Post. So years later, I'm not surprised. But I say all that to say, if all you want is a narrative, then you have to ignore lots of facts, because everything in life is nuanced and gray. I have learned that after a decade of prosecution, there is no black and white. Even with murder sometimes, frankly, sometimes it can be gray. And so it's really problematic when you just turn around and say, well, you shouldn't be able to take these things. And to your point, the justice system, many would say, is completely broken, especially in the United States, when you start to look at systemic racism and some of the things in our system that are just like horrifying. And when you look at all that, to say that we should eliminate one of, if not the most essential tool for helping the victims of financial crime, simply because a tiny, tiny percentage, and this was the evidence that DOJ gave, was a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of civil forfeiture are the ones that people actually raise objections to. Something like 95% of the seizures in administrative forfeiture are like uncontested. Nobody even comes forward and files a claim. And even sometimes I had ones where they filed a claim and it was just criminals. And then when they found out they had to come to court and file something under suit, they were like, we're willing to waive that claim because they don't want to come from China to file that. I'm like, oh, they don't want to subject themselves to the jurisdiction of the United States and possibly be sent to prison over their stuff? Call me shocked.
Shock horror. I literally was delivering training this morning. I use this very example when I'm trying to explain to people the power of non-conviction based forfeiture, how the vast majority, and I would agree with you, on the back of a napkin, 90% of the all, 95% of all the north of $1 billion seizures or $500 million seizures or more of crypto are all non-conviction based, because you've got that civil forfeiture sort of nailed on. And if you've got, I was using the example for training this morning, where you walking into an airport, finding a giant bag filled with, you know, cash, gold bars, and narcotics, and going, can the owner of the 3 kilos of cocaine and multiple unmarked small bills please come back? Customs would like to speak to you. Guess how many people come forward and claim their asset? Nobody.
And I think what some people don't realize, and this is the nerd part, and this is why so many of us in asset forfeiture would sometimes get frustrated with, I see criminal prosecutors. I was both a criminal prosecutor and an asset forfeiture prosecutor, which was wearing both hats was unique. I did criminal, civil, the whole gamut. And what's frustrating is that a lot of criminal prosecutors don't realize that civil forfeiture is often the safety net for when things go wrong in your case that you don't anticipate. This could be anything from you can't extradite the guy, you can't get charges approved, which happens, or worse, the guy kills himself because you actually need a body to prosecute. You charge a guy and he kills himself. Like, and this has happened, especially where I worked in Missouri in the U.S. Attorney's Office. Fun fact, only state in the United States where you can take out life insurance for yourself and actually collect if you commit suicide. So we actually had defendants that would get charged, take out a life insurance policy, kill themselves and their family and actually give money back to victims. I'm not suggesting this. This is not something that people should do. The point being that like civil asset forfeiture was there to say, look, we can actually still get the funds. Right? That is the thing, is it runs underneath like a safety net to say, worst case scenario, your criminal case falls apart. You can't get evidence. You can't get witnesses. You can't get a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt because 12 people disagree with what the evidence says. All of those things may not be your fault. But if you don't have civil forfeiture and you don't have the assets and you don't seize it, that is your fault because you didn't do the work. And that's what drove a lot of us crazy, is forfeiture and asset recovery is often longer and harder. To your point, if you kick in a door and there's dope, guns, and purses, and you can't manage to pick them up on your way out, that's the easy thing. But with crypto, with bank accounts, with real asset recovery, discovery where you have to trace it, find it, seize it. That is a legal process that takes work. And I once had a prosecutor that, because I used to be OCDEF and do narcotics cases. And I once worked with one of these like old dogs who looked at me and said, I don't do paper. And I was like, I'm sorry, what do you consider cash? What? Like, if it wasn't dope guns or things that he could seize out of a house, he did not lift a finger to investigate financial crime because he was a drug prosecutor. And I was like, this is what's killing us. And the lack of training and the lack of advancement and the lack of penalties for prosecutors that don't do their jobs on the criminal side is super frustrating. And the asset forfeiture attorneys of the world are just heartbroken over it.
I think that people lose perspective when they sort of think, no, why aren't we doing this around crypto? And we have all of these high standards. And I'm sort of the age that I can just, I was just there for like the turn of proper internet. I joined criminal investigation in revenue and customs, and I can remember, and we still had like the typing admin pool. We were typing up notes of your meetings and stuff. And all of these are not unique problems. And I think this is why systemically there's so much problems in asset recovery, because it's been around for so long. Crypto is just a microcosm. But like, I remember being at a training course where a financial investigator was pleading to like the tax and the customs guys going, you do know that you can use banking information in your cases. And they're like, why the hell would I want to talk to you guys? And they're like, they were given the case studies of why, and it just seems so like dumb now. But back then, like, you had to convince people to say, you've got a murder case and a hostage case and a terrorism case. Do you know that you can like track their ATM withdrawals and banking information? Get out of my way. We don't need an FINR team. And you were like having to, and even when SARS and STRs first came in, you know, you can just look through this information and get really good leads and develop cases and lead to seizure situations. You know, financial, we don't do that. We don't do that. So now when you see these attitudes towards non-conviction based forfeiture or even attitudes towards crypto, it's kind of like we always have to, like, you know, sometimes dinosaurs just need to get made extinct.
Well, and there's another way of saying that that people don't like, which is crypto didn't make anything new or change. I mean, crypto is a new technology, but when it comes to crime and asset recovery, what it really did was expose every crack in an undereducated, underutilized system.
It's like a big blanket over all of the systems that hits everything.
Yes, exactly. Is every time somebody in TradFi comes to me, and I remember I was at a conference and this banker stood up and was like, well, what are we going to do about the scams in crypto? And I was like, I guess something, because you didn't do squat for a decade when I was calling you. So now that you give a crap, I'm welcome to the discussion. Like, are you joking right now? Like, where do you think it was before it was in crypto? And when I called you about your lack of, you know, a tiered wired process, oh, that discussion, there was zero discussion about how to fix internal bank procedures to prevent scams, which were going through you. But now it's, how do we shut down crypto and save Aunt Agatha? And I'm like, that's the thing that I think people don't realize. I'm not so pro crypto. I'm a believer in the technology. I think a lot of us are. But I think one of the things that takes people by surprise about the Association for Women in Cryptocurrency is it's not an enthusiast group. It's a group for people who work in an industry who generally believe in the technology.
Yeah. You can be on prosecution and regulation. Yeah.
Yeah. But we've seen the horrible parts of it. All we want is nuanced and balanced and honest discussion and objective discussion, which is why when people come in and want to pretend that TradFi or crime before was doing a bang up job on preventing money laundering or seizing funds, I'm like, let's be clear, that system was broken and barely doing well. We're going to, I think, talk about how little asset recovery is done globally. Let's be clear, that's in TradFi and crypto. When you get to crypto, crypto exacerbates problems that existed. But to pretend that crypto suddenly created the problem of a lack of asset recovery, or suddenly created a problem of not being able to get a body, or suddenly created a problem, all it did was speed things up through giant existing cracks. And if you refuse to acknowledge the cracks and you just want to attack crypto, that's where I lose my mind, because I'm like, it reflects a complete and utter dishonesty. You have to fix the problems, and it will include crypto. But if you're not willing to talk about the problems in the system, the lack of education, the lack of training, the lack of tools, the lack of all the things that law enforcement and the financial institutions need to be able to do this well, like full stop, then you're not going to be able to do it in crypto, because you're going to attack a small little portion of the problem in crypto. And TradFi and everything else is still going to be a shit show.
It is. I was actually asked that. I was asked recently, am I anti-crypto or sort of anti, you know, TradFi? And I was like, no, I'm anti-hypocrisy. I don't need to pick a side. Like, it's kind of like a But it is true. For those that...
I'm anti-crime. Let's be clear. I'm anti-crime and I'm anti-hypocrisy. Crimocracy. Like, just call it that.
For those that don't know, or maybe are new to this sector, it is a bit of a reality check. And that's, again, for those that don't know, Acid Reality's name came about because we always keep saying the reality is. And I like to think of myself as a realist in these things, that I accept that if there's any system, there's always going to be cracks in every system. You know, cars got to have seatbelts and all that good stuff. But yeah, don't stand up and say, there's an issue here. What are we going to do about this sector? And the amount of governments I've worked with where it's like, ban it or regulate it. And they're all so binary conversations. And it's like, hold on a second. We have a traditional banking industry that has been cooperating, in inverted commas. And, you know, I've been on many task force and many wonderful people who work in sort of AML and global fin crime and all the compliance departments in the world. But if you have the heads of these banks, and if you have a system that allows banks to launder proceeds of crime for the Sinaloa cartel, if you can have to give back $4 billion for your part in the 1MDB scam, and if you have all the Danske Bank scandal, the Goldman Sachs scam, all of these things, HSBC, zero or like one or two criminal charges. We have some of the biggest auditors in the world that have been knowingly involved in criminal activity, and bar a scapegoat getting thrown like a lamb to the slaughter, zero accountability. And for me, it's almost become this like perverse thing when you look at some of the big exchanges that have been in trouble recently. It's kind of like, oh, they've just become a big business now. No, they've just become like all of the other big businesses around them.
With some exceptions, I will say that's probably true. I think there was a little bit more of the wild, wild west with crypto, where some of these exchanges were allowed to be effectively transnational money laundering organizations at a level that, like, yes, was the HSBC case bad? Danske, yes. But like, was it the egregious level that I think was found at some of the exchanges? No. Like, if a bank said we're located everywhere and nowhere so we don't have to be regulated, people's faces would be like, wait, what?
I'm happy to say on the record that I think many of the exchanges haven't got what they deserved yet. And you're right. They were blatantly and deliberately working to mislead. I like your example of the Wild West. And I think I heard it at a Chainalysis Links event. Seagal, I think it was maybe Seagal talking about Seagal. The Wild West. And to give her credit, it was 3 or 4 years ago, she talked about why...
Oh, trust me, everybody's been saying that for years. No, don't get me wrong, Seagal's brilliant, and I love her to death. She might have coined it, but like, the odds are pretty good.
But her bit was, that I remembered, was it was Wild West, but in a positive way, because of Wild West for innovation, plus the Wild West for, I use my Daniel Day-Lewis example of, no, there will be blood when he sort of breaks his leg. It's like, it's the Wild West, so if something goes wrong, it's not 2024 keyhole surgery. It's like, you got to chop your own leg off. And similarly, you could get robbed and looted, but also those that know how to manipulate the system, like the old British banking industry and import-export businesses of like the turn of the century, that nowadays are household names, but basically they built their fortunes on the looting and pillaging globally.
Look, no offense, but if you hadn't had the Wild West, you wouldn't have the state of California. But nobody looks at the state of California and says, boy, it was worth all the death and all of the absolute craziness that happened in the middle. And I really like this analogy, and I forget the guy's name. I need to look it up, but he's like the chief experience officer at Ledger or something. He did this amazing interview on the PGP podcast, with Gary Weinstein, that I loved. And he basically, because he used to work, he worked like all the way back in Winamp or something. I can't, like OG digital music, right? And he gave this analogy that has stuck with me, and I've stolen it and used it 1,000 times, talk about attribution. But he said basically like, look, you and I are old enough to remember Napster. When Napster came out, I was sitting in my college dorm with a T3 internet connection, downloading as many thousands of songs onto a hard drive as I could, because as a pre-law student, I knew this illegal gravy cheering will end 100%, right? I carried that hard drive of like 200,000 songs with me until the day I became a federal prosecutor. I was like, okay, this is what's called getting rid of the evidence. Get rid of it, right? But at the time, we'll
edit it in that you're talking about a friend, right. So that you're not admitting to some sort of offense.
Statute of limitations, baby. Statute of limitations. But like, we all knew, right, that was 100% illegal. There's no way this is going to survive. You cannot have the just free flow of digital files, right? Blatant copyright violation. Like those artists, like I had no sympathy for Metallica. They handled that wrong. But everybody else, right? I felt terrible. Like, I should just send you like $1 or something. Like Enya, I think I mailed her a check for $10. All of her music, entire library download.
On behalf of the people of Ireland, we say thank you.
Exactly. 100% apologize, because God knows I got most of that woman's music free sitting in my dorm room. But the point being that, like, you had to have Napster to show the CD industry that the world was done paying for 2 good songs and 12 garbage songs for $13. And the CD industry was like, this isn't going to last, right? 10, 20 years later, the joke is on them. The thing was, if you didn't have Napster, you wouldn't have had LimeWire. You wouldn't have had Kazaa. You wouldn't have had all these, right? You wouldn't have had all these iterations of digital music. And now you've got these kids running around loving Apple Music and Spotify, not having any idea that none of it happens without the shakeup.
Do you know the virus and malware that we went through to download these songs? We were the Wild West guinea pigs.
Yes, exactly. And when I explain people that we're just simply maybe at the LimeWire or Kazaa moment of crypto, and maybe none of this is what we end up with, right? These layer one, layer two protocols, like rollups, oracles, all these things that people have no idea what it is. All of it could just be the LimeWire and Kazaa. But there is no question that the future of digital finance is going to be different, and that the Cobalt system that some of these ancient banks are running on that cannot be built. You cannot turn a steam engine track into a light rail, right? Like, you can't do that. So the tech improvement that's going to have to be made is massive. And that's the situation that people get. And then people understand it's not about speculative crap coins. It's about what is the technology that people are building and what is the future of digital finance look like? And you're going to have some broken eggs. You're going to have some dead bodies. Like, I say dead bodies referring to the Wild Wild West analogy.
Of course.
But you're going to have some crime in the path of innovation. We've never not had crime on the path to development and innovation.
It's an impossibility. You just can't get there. And that's why I like that the hypocrisy line with you. It's the people that are, you know, it's the Simpsons character, and won't somebody think of the children, that sort of shrieks in horror every time. And you're saying, like, we've been here in every single innovative, you create cars, then eventually airbags and seatbelts come along. That's my icebreaker. I was born the year seatbelts were made legal in the UK. So that's my, I was clearly, and also the biggest asset recovery case in the UK, the Brinksmat robbery. Two things that happened the year I was born. True story.
Well, look, this is one of the reasons why I'm so, like, I wish they would do more about asset recovery, because there are fundamental things in asset recovery that would help crypto that would also help TradFi. So if you want to have a conversation about how to do asset recovery better, I am here for it, because it will improve both, right? But you have the same exacerbated issues in crypto, is it moves too fast, too globally for the current system. And that's its biggest problem. And this is why civil asset recovery, in some cases, lawyers who are able to reach out to foreign exchanges can move faster in some ways than law enforcement that has to go through certain channels. And the channels are so slow, right? The MLAT process, that, like, the treaties that countries have government to government, is really difficult compared to a lawyer that can just send a Norwich Pharmacol or Bankers Trust, one of the two. But they have these, like, special orders where it's like, I'm entitled to assets anywhere I find in the world, right? Hey, you exchange, give them to me. So, you know, there's certain processes that the civil procedure has. Now, don't get me wrong. If you talk to asset recovery lawyers in the civil space, they will tell you crypto is hard. It moves very fast. And crypto asset recovery does exacerbate problems, because if you don't have good tracers, if you don't have people fast enough, this is a problem. I will say, like, and I don't know if you want to get into it, but, like, there are developments in blockchain analytics that I think are really exciting on that front. There's a company I'm excited about called Heights Labs, and they're building tools that are faster auto tracers, because the reality is it can't take 6 months to a year to build a crypto tracer, and it has to be something that's really accessible to everyone. And the problem is that right now, a lot of the tools, you know, I tell you this joke all the time and we laugh, but, like, you got a lot of people who are being given TI-82 calculators who don't know how to do trigonometry. That's difficult, right? You got to teach people how to do trig. Trig's not easy. I barely passed that class, right? If what you want to do is kick in doors, seize guns and drugs, following money is a very difficult thing. So you have to make it a lot easier. And there are tools that are auto tracing that are saying, like, here, instantly, here's where your money went. Subpoena this exchange, right? Then after you get the records, you can figure out, like, okay, now we can go back, do the trace, you know, make a record for court, do all that stuff. But we have to be smarter about the investigative process and how we trace and track this money. And I think those advances are really helping, but you kind of have to stay on top of it, because the one true thing is that crime flows like a river. It will find a way. way and it flows fast. And keeping up with it is part of the problem, whether it's crypto, whether it was green dot money pack cards, that was the big thing for a while, right? Nobody said shut down the entire giant GPR industry just because green dot literally just let money flow out to criminals for years, right? Had congressional hearings on it, did not shut down green dot, still had GPR cards. So I say all that to say that, like, I think there's discussions about how we have to do things better. I think those of us in crypto blockchain world would just say, can we have a nuanced, objective conversation about how to do this full stop and stop pretending that crypto is the problem, right? Like, crypto exacerbated existing problems, but it did not create those problems.
And the argument that we're going to actually pose is that it actually contains the blueprint for improving asset recovery, because the statistics speak for themselves. We are seeing $1 billion seizures at a astonishing rate. We are seeing, I can think on one hand, the amount of $1 billion seizures in fiat and sort of traditional finance cases that I track over the last sort of 5 to 10 years, where it's just becoming a more common thing. And I think it's back to the civil forfeiture that you'd mentioned earlier. It's kind of like we've turned up into a new healthy, river that is filled with fish that has never been fished in before. So there's always going to be that just initial bounty of illicit assets because people were operating thinking that they weren't being spotted, not realizing, hey, this is no super traceable blockchain thing, combined with, and I think people forget about the amount of like OSINT investigation and just traditional police work that goes into. The tools make it faster, the tools can corroborate what you're doing, but you've still got to be able to sort of at least back it up a bit. I think that that's where there is that bounty to be had in crypto cases. But finishing off that point on the non-conviction based forfeiture that you'd mentioned in the US, that's what astonishes me in the US, and I wonder, is it just like political posturing? Because FATF, the sort of intergovernmental body, they announced in November, like, asset recovery, that's the new target, and they're actually telling countries you have to bring in a non-conviction-based confiscation regime into your country if you don't have one. And you've got to, so actually the US could, it would be quite hilarious if the US put itself on the grey list because it took away the one thing that FATF are saying everyone has to have going forward, because it is so, because people won't know this, especially the US and UK listeners, that there are actual cases around the world where they have containers of cash, properties that they cannot do anything with because they don't have the person, because they've absconded or they can't be found. And it's like, we can't set, all these assets are just stuck in purgatory. We have cases where the asset is 15 years seized, and it's because unless they come into the country or we find them, we can't ever issue the final conviction, which means we can't trigger the next stage of asset recovery. So it's so much an important part that it seems like a ridiculous argument to talk about getting rid of it.
Let's be clear. There's a lot of reasons why the United States would be on the gray list if FATF was actually like inspecting us. You could just start with the South Dakota Secret Trust. You could start with the states in the West that actually told us as federal prosecutors that they would disclose our subpoenas. If we subpoenaed the Secretary of State to find out who was behind an entity, that they would disclose to the registered entity the existence of our subpoena, like that we needed an act of Congress to prevent states from facilitating money laundering. Trust me when I say that there are so many reasons why the United States could be on the gray list because somebody at FATF was like actually coming in, right? Like the same with the UK.
Yeah.
This is why
they invented the term offshore banking to make it seem like it was like the US and the UK are like the top two money laundering entities in the world. But yeah.
100%.
That's for an entire podcast on its own.
That crimocracy is a discussion for another podcast, right? But to your point, it is a huge problem. I think there's a statute, a proposed statute that's floating around. I think it's ironically titled the FAIR Act to abolish most of non-conviction-based forfeiture in the United States. It somehow managed to get out of committee, and I wrote to one of the bill's co-sponsors and was like, you could not possibly have known how horrible this was. I imagine that the lobby to abolish non-conviction-based forfeiture was just way more like in your face than law enforcement victims' rights. And also victims' rights tend to be for assault, like physical, there aren't a lot of victims groups, unfortunately, for economic crime, which is really horrifying when you think about it, because in many ways it does just as much damage, right? Like we have lots of cases where people commit suicide where There's, to your point, right, all
the stuff that Aaron West is talking about, pig butchering, like the things, just the scale of that.
Yeah. Exactly, right? And so the idea that the United States would pass a statute that would actually put it in direct contradiction to FATF standards, I have to believe there's somebody awake at Treasury who would say, we can't do this, just FYI, this cannot happen. And if not, I will be screaming outside on the steps of the Capitol, like literally with a sign saying, please, please, please do not do this for millions and millions of financial crime victims. Look, I served on the January 6th committee for a year. I've seen the United States.
I was just waiting to say, you know more about standing on the steps screaming at the Capitol building than most. You have a unique perspective of someone who does that.
Trust me, of all the things to get up on the Capitol steps about, right? The abolishment of non-conviction-based forfeiture is where I will plant my flag. But I say all that.
I demand my rights to keep my stolen assets.
Exactly. I'm going to throw a chair through a window if you try to abolish non-conviction-based forfeiture. Because to be clear, that is worth throwing a chair through the window of Congress. If they get that close, I will be there. You'll see me coming. It'll be entirely preventable. But the chair will get thrown. It'll like go like 5 feet. It'll land. Yeah. It won't go through a window. But somebody will take a really sad little picture. And it'll say January 6th committee representative attacks Capitol over abolishment of non-conviction based.
And the irony will be, we'll seize your car for doing
that. Thank God I don't own a car, but if I drove one there, I'm sure they'd take it. But I do think there's so many good points that you raised about throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I do think, you know, Steph Casella, the godfather of asset forfeiture, who literally wrote our statute, CAFRA.
I got to meet him virtually for the first time. Big friend of our mutual friends, TJ.
Yeah. Thank God. He seems to have no intention of actually retiring. And God bless his wife for letting him not retire. But he travels the world basically teaching, training, and helping countries like establish non-conviction-based forfeiture programs. So I think with the FATF rule, other countries are going to do better. They are trending up there. They have to, right? I think that's good for crypto for many reasons, because like we talked about earlier, it's a framework. You know, Aaron West as a state prosecutor has gotten some amazing recoveries. Jonathan Scharf in Queens, Alona Katz in Brooklyn, like they are able to get amazing recoveries when the bodies are gone because of civil asset forfeiture. So this is a essential tool for helping victims. I don't think that can be understated. One of the things that you picked on that I do want to go back to, because I think it's a really important point, is the visibility. And Austin Campbell wrote this really great op-ed in, I think it was like a Federal Newswire, where he talked about like the theater of terrorist financing and the reality of terrorist financing. And basically what he was saying was that what crypto is a victim of is its visibility, right? Because, and the one thing I disagree with him on is that it wasn't invisible. I can tell you, having been in illicit finance at DOJ, terrorist financing was not invisible. You can actually watch Jack Ryan series on Amazon. Yeah, and you can get a pretty good idea about how we were tracking terrorist financing and how well we were doing it. Trust me when I say that there were many of us who knew exactly how terrorist financing was working. The problem was operationalizing it, and there was no will and there was no pressure because, to his point, it wasn't in your face visible with a public address saying, this is where Hamas is storing the money. It's right here. What are you doing about it? And I think people don't understand that optics are very, very real and dictate so much of what happens in governments, right? Because with 24-hour news stations and with social media, I literally had very high-level government officials say we can't because of the optics of it, even though it's the 100% wrong, like right or wrong doesn't matter. Like legal or illegal, sometimes that's questionable. But as soon as optics are involved, now it's a horse of a different color. And it drives me insane because, you know, Elizabeth Warren is out here mounting an anti-crypto army over terrorist financing. I'm like, Senator Warren, where were you with the anti-counterfeit army? Because hundreds of millions of dollars in counterfeit goods have been going to terrorism financing for years. We've known that. I didn't see your anti-counterfeit army. Where was that? To be clear, like I'm walking around in San Francisco, and from what I can tell, you ain't doing anything about one of the major sources of terrorist financing. There's someone fake Gucci on the streets, girl. What you gonna do about it? Like, if you want to attack terrorist financing, do something effective. Going after the tiny percentage that's in crypto, that's where you want to start, because that's where it's most visible. And
that's the theater he's talking about, because politically, that's where the headlines work both ways. You can be seen to be the ambassador for this noble pursuit, as they think.
That's the theater, is where were you for decades when we absolutely saw millions of dollars in state-sponsored financing in Hawaladars. You didn't shut down all the Hawaladars because real people needed that service to transfer money to their family. Guess what? Crypto is the same.
Are you going to shut down Western Union? Yeah.
Just because you don't send money to your family in crypto, it doesn't mean that the remittance market hasn't moved to it. And it is a giant use case. That's where the hypocrisy, I think, drives people absolutely insane.
Well, should we shut down email or let's ban the internet? And where do you draw the line? That we had this conversation about
DeFi. Took them a decade, right? Like, I got a check a decade after being the victim of a scam in 2006. I was working at DOJ. Aiden, I'm not even kidding you. I got a letter in the mail that a decade later, as the victim of a fraud scam that transferred her funds via Western Union, I think I got like $200 back because 10 or 15 years later, somebody finally popped Western Union for all of the criminal activity that it had been facilitating. Finally, DOJ comes after it 15 years later. I'm like, hey, you were fine waiting 15 years to go after Western Union, but you want crypto to stop right now? Stop it. Just stop it right now. And I'm like, come on.
You want Game of Thrones style retribution, red wedding, like yeah. That afternoon type of thing. I think the theater part actually plays a bigger part in underperforming asset recovery. And we've hit the nail on the head. There's this global statistic of 1% of criminal proceeds is finally intercepted. Lots of people right now will be listening to this and sort of screaming that it's not 1%. And the fact is, like, no, come at me with the statistic being wrong. That's part of the problem. The last time this was even tracked, the data set is from 2010 to 2014, pre the crypto sort of explosion as well. So we have an old data set. We also then combine that against in the TradFi where long before crypto, we estimate $2 to $5 trillion is laundered every single year. So again, this is where we have a creaky system. And I like your analogy of the fact that like water flows, it just finds the cracks. And all crypto does is just accelerate everything. So it's instead of having 9-to-5 stock trading, we've got 24/7. Instead of having no newspapers reporting things, we have the internet always on. So I think it's just it's the speeding up of sort of society. But the theater bit, I think that to your point, it also has been around for decades. Because I can remember as an investigator, and it still happens to this day, we have the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and we have tons of sanction seizures, like, you know, grinning politicians. It's in the intro to this podcast. We talk about, you know, seizing these big boats with no plan whatsoever on how to turn that sanction, which is not an asset recovery tool, how to turn that into an actual confiscation. What is the plan to flip that into a non-conviction based forfeiture? How do you do this bit next? And if you ask someone in the UK, how many money laundering cases have we taken? Standalone money for those enablers who the bankers, the lawyers. Do you know, actually, the one of the first pure, and this should astonish like normal non-asset recovery or government people, like there hasn't been many like money laundering cases. Money laundering is often tacked on as an offence to the wider thing, but people actually involved in money laundering, there's a handful of cases. And one of the most interesting cases in the world right now is in Kosovo. Has successfully delivered a standalone money laundering conviction in all cases, the OneCoin case.
Oh, yeah.
So the individuals involved in transmitting money in that case have been prosecuted. It was actually the Egmont Group's like sort of case of the year type thing. But so I do agree on the theater point that it's this venue issue has been an issue with asset recovery. Everything is just, you know, is on such a massive global political pedestal that it's like it's the new kid on the block. But do you think there's a bit of, you know, the sector of analytic tools, you worked in Chainalysis, you've been around all of this in its early days, relatively speaking, in terms of enforcement. Do you think that this, you know, with great power comes great responsibility sort of thing applies, that because we know that we can actually close a lot of the doors and shut off a lot of the off-ramps, and do you think it's right that crypto is held to a higher standard? Because we can all agree that TradFi has got it wrong for decades, and we can agree that politicians haven't went after some of the banks when they should have and demanded these changes. Do you think it is fair that there is an element of, you're the fastest car on the block, you have to have additional controls in place? Because we've seen that when it goes wrong in crypto, it goes spectacularly wrong.
To me, it's not a matter of fairness. And to be clear, I actually don't, it's not that I think crypto is being held to a higher, I don't know that crypto is being held to a quote higher standard. What I think crypto, like to Austin's point, crypto is a victim of its own success in that crypto is forcing people to look at who we've really become, like what humanity, who we really are. And unfortunately, like when you look at tools like Chainalysis, like my experience is largely with Chainalysis, right? And if you're in Reactor is able to tag things as this is a darknet market. This is right, a card selling service, right? And your funds are 50%. It's 80% indirect exposure. Here's all the money laundering. And unfortunately, what it did was it actually pointed out to the world how little we give a flying beep about money laundering, to your point. Because what TradFi allowed us to do, and this is the funny thing, is like banks do this, but they do this in like a banker way where they're like, you're having us pay an inordinate amount of money to do nothing. In fact, we file all these reports and you don't do anything with them. We spend millions, if not billions of dollars, and nothing happens to it, which is a really nice way of saying, you don't give a flying F about money laundering. Why are you having us pay for all of these reports? You do nothing with it. You don't train people how to use it.
Millions of reports filed every year that just
millions of reports are filed that just sit. Why are you pretending that this is important to you and you're making us that this is the theater? And I struggle with this because as somebody who used the reports that are filed, it is a great system. If people actually used it, it's a great system. The problem is we don't use it. We don't enforce it. We don't train enough on it.
Is that a resource or is that politically motivated? Or why do you think?
It's both. It's both, right? Like, that's the problem. Can I get a congressman to call up the state of South Dakota and say, stop it with your secret trust? Can I get him to call other states in the West and say, stop it with your... No, because there's no political will.
You don't want to annoy your bankers. It's like the UK.
Luke Raven on LinkedIn, he's done some great posts on this where he's like, because he focuses a lot on Australia. But like every single country, the lack of political will to do anything about money laundering is a massive problem. And this is where it's unfair for crypto, because crypto literally holds up a sign and says, but here's the terrorist financing and here's the money laundering.
Yeah, you have to do something with it.
So which do you care about? And because you have to do something with it, because you can see it. The visibility, it's like literally standing in front of a pile of money covered in cocaine powder. You could literally get high if you just breathe too heavily and somebody saying, do we actually have a problem with cocaine and money covered in cocaine? Like, because it's right in front of you. What are you going to do? And that's the problem with crypto, is the visibility shoves in front of you all of this money. It's like that stat. I don't know if you've ever heard that stat, the percentage of US dollars that have some amount of cocaine on it is like off the charts. It's the reality of the permutation of cocaine in our society, that people love to think recreational cocaine isn't a thing. And I'm like, you have no idea. You have no idea the number of legitimate lawyers, doctors.
It's just one big drug dealer somewhere.
Right. It is just one underground, like, recreational coke world, right?
Oh, listen, the UK Houses of Parliament, they've done, like, you know, they've sent an investigative journalist and they found traces of it in the toilet. Yes.
Yeah, So what crypto does, unfortunately, is expose the theater of humanity, that we love to pretend that we signed this wonderful social contract to be against terrorist financing and money laundering. And what we really did was do a mediocre job at terrorist financing and a piss poor job at fighting
money
laundering.
It seems to me it's like, it's becoming like the urine test that you can't hide any of the results.
That's right. And TradFi was like, I resist that test. I choose not to take the test. And crypto's like peeing everywhere. And somebody's like, dude, oh my God, like I just held up a test in the air and caught some of your pee. And this is terrorist financing. Like, Jesus, right? It's like, that is the reality. That is the best way to put it. Crypto is the urine test for crime that nobody can ignore.
We'll have to edit that out in a better way. It'll have to be like the breath.
Don't you dare edit
that
out.
No, it's like the breathalyzer test. Like, it's like the resistance.
Yeah, there we go.
The breathalyzer
test.
Whereas, yeah.
That's the classic.
We're never going to get through all the things that we wanted to talk about, because you've had such an interesting sort of career to date. I definitely want to talk about, obviously, we met through sort of your work in Chainalysis, and you were in the crypto sector, and you've now quite rightly been on a very sort of noble crusade. Tell me a little bit about work and what sort of led to the creation of that.
So it's funny, I was at DOJ and I was in a group called Women in Law, and it did a lot of professional development events, right? Like how to basically like be better at professionalizing, for lack of a better word. And there was another group called DOJ Gen, and it was the gender advocacy group. And I went to an event and I bumped into the woman who ran that. And I said, oh, you know, we do similar things. We should partner on an event. And she said, no, thank you. And I was so taken aback. And I was like, I'm sorry. I thought we wanted the same thing. She's like, no, not really. You see, women are playing in a rigged game. And we, DOJ Gen, are trying to change the rules of that rigged game. And you're just trying to make everybody Serena Williams. And that comment really stuck with me, because she was right. And years later, I went and left the government and went to Chainalysis and saw how women were treated in the government generally, like in crypto. There were a lot of us women. We were mostly the profile of crypto. And then I got to the private sector, and you would have thought there were no women because of the way that the private sector treats women, both in TradFi, in tech. And then when two crapheads have a baby, of course, their baby's going to be a craphead. So the baby of fintech, right? Crypto and blockchain, not so great on inclusion. The difference is what I have found, and I started the association because I was like, we can do this better. We can build this in. And if we build it in from the foundational layer, then we have a chance of actually building in inclusion into a nascent industry. I say nascent in air quotes because it's 13 years old, but that's a discussion for another day.
In banking terms, it's still a pup.
Yeah, it's nascent in banking terms, right? But what I have found is that in my discussions with a lot of the folks in crypto, blockchain, and Web3, especially male, I find a lot of allies because you have people who came from TradFi, who came from tech, whose mindset was the current system is broken and we need to improve it. Banking is broken. Tech is broken, right? Like this is broken. We need to fix it. So you have a bunch of people who are in an industry who fundamentally acknowledged that what we had was broken and we could do better. So they're already in a mindset of building better. So the concept
of accepting change.
And so the concept of building better, their fathers, their sons, their uncles, right? Like they know a woman. They've seen mansplaining. They've watched a woman get harassed. We're going to put out a survey in the next few weeks. And one of the most amazing statistics that came from our inclusion survey that we conducted at the end of last year, that nearly 50% of males surveyed knew that women had harassment problems in the industry.
And what they do, yeah.
That's amazing. That's a level of awareness that's both horrifying and impressive, right? Like in the sense that there's a real problem, but at least half of them know about it.
Acknowledging that, yeah, it could have been much worse, that it could have just been completely disregarded.
Exactly, which is what it felt like in prior industries. So I see a lot of hope, and that's why I love what we're doing in the association, which is taking the words, and that woman probably has no idea the impact she left on me, but like taking the words of what she said and saying it has to be both. We have to both change the rules of a rigged game, which is the advocacy initiatives that we do, which I'm very excited about, Unmantle Your Panel, where we've got a bunch of allies. We've got 42 now. We're working towards getting 100 male allies who pledge not to speak on a mantle. I say that because I know you're one of them, and I'm so grateful for that. We're talking with conferences that are pledging to have at least 30% women speakers on substantive panels, not women in blank. And then we're also building a global speaker directory online that'll start with our members, but then we'll have any woman who wants to participate, who wants to put her bio up, so that conference planners and organizers will have a resource of willing women who will say yes to speaking, which is a whole nother discussion. But I say all that to say that it has to be things like that changing, making actual systemic change. But then it also does have to be professional development. It does have to be making people Serena, because unfortunately, until the rules change, it is rigged and you have to be better. That's just the reality.
Yeah, you are going to have to be. Like, it goes back to this theme of reality. And this is why we're, without sort of shamelessly plugging ourselves, we're sort of delighted to be working with you, because I mean, if our mission is to, you know, fix asset recovery. I say fix as an, you know, impossible, unending task, but to improve it. I always remembered, and it's no reflection on my views on the person himself, but I always remembered, it's really stuck with me, that the Warren Buffett quote about being optimistic for the future. He's got, like, let's not forget, for the entire history of time, we've sort of basically used 50% of our resources. Everything is possible over the next 10, 20, 30, 40 decades. As we start to think about, Bezos and Musk talk about this. They talk about like interplanetary, because why? He says, because if we have X amount of brilliant innovators amongst a population of Y, I want Y to be X'd, or and times two and times three and times four, because that is the issue. We have historically just been dogged by those problems. And maybe there's a, you know, logical conclusion that if we keep doing what we've always done, and we wonder, why are we always stuck in the same 1%? Why are we always stuck? Is it because of the same laws and the same ignorance and the same things not applying? So anything that drives change from us and sort of doing the right thing is something we want to keep pushing and keep supporting, because there's nothing's going to change unless there's some drastic innovative ways of thinking. People that have also been through a bit of hardship, we can't keep doing things the way we've done them.
And I will say this, I think I want to put a little asterisk after drastic, because I do think change is needed, right? But when I look at the Unmantle Your Panel initiative, and when I look at how hard it's been to get men to pledge not to speak on an all-male panel, that is courage. Because I talked to a guy who works for a very big company, who his company has so much money that if he were to say no to a speaking experience, it would have zero impact. Emphasis, zero impact. But the company has policies and they have something and they don't want to say no, and there's commercial risk and like all this stuff. And there's all these excuses for why it's so easy and commercially beneficial to do nothing. And so it doesn't always take a big drastic thing. It takes a thing. And just saying, I'm not going to speak on an all-male panel, just being the guy, I'll never forget a guy came to one of our events in London, and we did the facilitated networking, and he sat through the entire thing, and he came up to me afterwards. He's like, Amanda, the wildest thing happened. I saw this man, and while we were answering the questions, he started explaining to one of the women the answer to her question. It was so unnecessary. I've never seen this. Do you have this? Do you see this? And I said, did you just ask me if I've ever seen a man unnecessarily explain something to a woman? Have I ever seen mansplaining?
There's a wonderful infinite loop of mansplaining.
But the problem But here's the thing, bless his heart. You know what he goes, oh my God, I've heard that term, but I've never seen it. And Aiden, when I tell you, his face registered what mansplaining actually is, because it registered with him in a situation where he was one of five men in a room of 40. He also said, is this what it's like for you at conferences? Empathy and experiencing that is drastic in and of itself. So we invite men to come to our events all the time. They are always welcome. Men are always welcome at our event, because the men who do show up are generally allies in the making. They may not know it at the time, but being willing to step into a room where you are the minority and it's all women and you're here and you're open to it, that's an ally in training. And 99 times out of 100, those men leave and are our greatest supporters. They're our greatest advocates. That guy said, pledged to me that the next time he sees it on his work calls, which he now was like, I think I've seen it actually quite a bit now that I'm thinking about it. He's like, I'm going to shut it down. Because if you make women fix the problem, it's hopeless. If we recruit men and they see it and they are our best and strongest allies, men were my strongest allies when I started the association. You, Glenn Pomerantz at BDO. Yes, Julie Frizzer at Norton Rose, but like men across the board, like Darren Levy at Levy Firestone, Ari Redboard at TRM Labs. I could go on and on and on about the men that stood up, that gave us money, that supported us. Seth Ducharme at Bracewell. Literally, the list goes on and on. It's men who have come forward to support us. And I'm not saying women haven't. I'm just saying I'm really grateful for men who step forward and say, why don't we alleviate the burden from women of having to solve this problem on their own and help? And I can't thank those men enough, because allyship is difficult. It doesn't even have to be drastic, but making change on any level, being the person to step out there and say what we've been doing could be done better, is very difficult. And that to me is courage.
It is a big step for some people. I do. And look, like I said, we could do a separate podcast just on sort of stoicism and getting comfortable with the uncomfortable, and Aaron West's polar swim the other day. But I think this is why I wanted to bring that up. Because again, going back to the sort of the asset recovery theme of all of this, is that, you know, things have to be done differently. And it's, for me, it's the perfect sort of marriage, is that if we also have that way of having it at the same time, then we are going to get new ideas and innovation and bravery. Give me your closing magic wand. We've talked about asset recovery being underperforming. We've talked about the 1%. We've talked about the interplay of crypto assets, and we're seeing $1 billion seizures all the time. The 1% statistic is going to change because of crypto. But part of me also worries that a little bit of that is that initial bounty, because there's just so much assets out there. It's like finding gold or oil for the first time. So we're going to have a bit of a false dawn in terms of statistics and collections. But part of me believes that a lot of the forced innovation, the collaboration, public-private partnerships, all of those things that get talked about but never really get done, we're now seeing them. We're seeing spectacular examples in government agencies. I saw the other day, partnership with a local tech company that created an AI tool for profiling SARS. So a government that is actually going through big data sets and going, whoa, there's a good case, there's a good case, there's a good case, feeding it down the line. If you were queen for a day, what do you think needs to be the leading reform? If I said, we've got to increase performance and asset recovery, what would you do?
I think the problem, well, if I was queen for a day, I would say, don't bet on aircraft carriers to win the war. It's going to be the F-16 fighter jets, right? I have this saying that, like, you know, the United States, unfortunately, has been a big, fat, out of shape bully for too many years. And that only works until 30 scrappy kids on a playground figure out that 30 against one can overtake a fat, lazy bully. And I think what you're seeing is nimble administrations, nimble governments, and everybody's like, yeah, but America has to wait. And I'm like, America waits to its peril. But we've known for years that big data science, analytics, AI, like all of these things could enrich data. We could be so much smarter. We could be saving so much money. The banks have known it. The banks have been doing their own programs, and the regulators are behind. Regulation is behind. You've got a 1970s statute, the Bank Secrecy Act, passed for cash, that is dictating how digital currencies should be monitored and tracked for anti-money laundering and terrorist financing. It's a non-workable solution. They keep trying to shove a square peg into a round hole, and it's not going to work, because cash in a mattress is different than digital currency that can move at the speed of light instantly anywhere in the world. And you're going to see these administrations, like these governments like Singapore, UAE, countries, the UK, frankly, countries around the world that are acknowledging we have to do something. It doesn't have to be perfect, but we have to put up a rail, and you can change the rail. But if you have no rail, the bus goes off the cliff. And this is the problem that America is having, is if you do nothing and you just sit and float, which unfortunately America has gotten into a position of doing absolutely nothing. That is its biggest problem right now, is that the administration has done as much as it can. Regulators like are limited. Congress, the most broken body. If I learned anything from being on the January 6th committee, it is that Congress is the most broken thing in the world right now. And you see it too. Amazing statespeople with best intentions working in a utterly broken system that even if they want to make change, even if they want to do the right thing, they can't. There's so many just institutional barriers. And that's really, I think, a problem that we have right now. And the problem is that I think literally today we're having a hearing in the United States House Financial Services Committee is having part two of illicit finance. They're going to talk about all the things that we could be doing, all the crime that's going through crypto. And the reality is they need to do something. And right now it's so difficult to get anything done in Congress, even the right things. Stablecoin legislation should be a no-brainer. I don't have strong feelings either way about stablecoins, but they're the 14th largest purchaser of treasury bills, and we're losing dollar dominance every day. If you want the dollar to stay the global reserve currency, pass a stablecoin bill. This isn't brain surgery. This isn't complicated. This is literally just pass a stablecoin bill. Like, you have to.
You're just watching the pot
boiling
over.
You're literally just watching a slow boil of a pot. And later on down the road, when global currency reserves continue to drop, they're the lowest they've ever been in history. When they continue to drop, when they hit 40, 30%, and it's not the yuan or the ruble that takes over, and it's a basket of alternative fiat and digital currencies, right? And that slow boil cooks that frog in a pot, and sanctions aren't effective because you can have sanctions evasions if there's alternative paths. Now the national security risk of losing dollar dominance, thanks to the invention of countless crypto and digital currencies, all of a sudden it's like, we were screaming, we were warning you, but you thought stable coins were the enemy instead of seeing that they're the future of payment rails. But it's not for lack of information.
Yeah, it is the fusion. And I think it's one of the biggest topics that we'll probably do a bit of a special on this, because every country we go into, there's almost this like schizophrenia where one part of the country wants to ban crypto, the other part of the country wants to get tough on crypto and money laundering, illicit finance, and then simultaneously the same small jurisdiction is launching its own digital currency. And you're going like, you're doing, and this is why no one gets along, because they're all doing different things, pulling in different directions. And all the while, the money launderers are standing back going, perfect.
That's right. They win.
You've just created multiple diversions for us to operate. But like you say, you've built roads, but no guide rails. So you're welcoming people. And we've seen this in different jurisdictions where they were grey listed because they welcomed the exchanges with open arms and then didn't put up any of the guide rails. And then they wonder why FATF then comes down on them like a ton of bricks. Amanda, I could do this for hours, but unfortunately, I have a day job. I have other things.
Me too.
But listen, thank you so much for joining us. And there's no doubt we will do a bunch of follow-ups. And we'll put it in the show notes, the theater article of Moss. And I think that's my takeaway point from this, is that maybe we have to take part in the theater a little bit more to sort of get our points heard in asset recovery. And giving your audition of all your various amateur dramatics and accents, I have a funny feeling you'll be a big part of this theater group as we go forward.
I'm going to get canceled so hard after this by all my British and Irish friends who are like, we told you only do that when you're drinking. What part of that was unclear?
And it's like 9 a.m. or 10. You don't even have an excuse right now. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
We're grateful to Amanda for sharing her time and insights with us today. Please check out the Women in Cryptocurrency podcast and website, womenincrypto.org, to learn more about how you can join or participate in the Women in Cryptocurrency Association. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, like and subscribe to the Cease and Desist podcast on your preferred platform, and leave a comment and any suggestions for future episodes. Next time, Aiden will be joined by Ari Redbord, Global Head of Policy and Government Affairs at TRM Labs and former Assistant U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. They'll be exploring why criminals are drawn to using traceable technology and the role of blockchain analytics in dismantling their operations and seizing their illicit proceeds. Don't miss it. Cease and Desist is brought to you by Asset Reality. Thank you for listening.